Hello and welcome to episode 128 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a policy analyst, criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is my interview with Ashish Prashar about the media, incarceration, police, and criminal justice reform. Ashish Prashar currently serves as Global Chief Marketing Officer at RGA, having over 17 years of experience in communications. He is a seasoned campaigner, political strategist, writer, and executive building global brands. Ashish has had a lengthy career in politics, where he handled communications for the Conservative Party, former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, and was a press secretary to the former Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. Some might have heard of him. In the United States, Ashish worked on the Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, the 2018 midterms for the Democrats, and most recently, President Joe Biden's 2020 campaign. Ashish was incarcerated at a young age and went on to create programs for the formerly incarcerated, campaign for clean slate, bail reform, ending solitary confinement, and the restoration of voting rights, all things I definitely agree with. So thank you for that. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Ashish.
Thanks for having me, Josh. It's a privilege to be on.
Great to have you. And quick congratulations. I believe you just had a kid, so we should...
Yeah, it's a symbolic moment. I mean, I think it's 20 years since I was released from a Young Offenders Institute, and my partner and my newborn was born days away from the anniversary. So it's quite a momentous time.
That's amazing. You couldn't celebrate it a better way.
No, not at all.
I always ask the same first question. How did you get from wherever you started in life to where you were the global chief marketing officer at RGA?
I guess it does start.
I know that's a long question.
Oh, that's a long question. I mean, I could start all the way, but I think the interesting thing is for me, it's like it does start around 20 years ago where I first experienced firsthand, you know, the prison industrial complex. But over in the UK, everyone has this like picturesque. A lot of people still have a picturesque view of Europe and the UK as being more liberal and more progressive. But you know, the UK prisons are equally as brutal, if not worse, in some places in the UK as they are here. And I was incarcerated at 17. Look, I grew up in a middle class family in London, and at 16, like my parents divorced, and that single event doesn't seem like a significant one right now, but nevertheless, at that time, led to the collapse of all I knew to be true at that moment. My dad wasn't in the best place. My mom had left. And I found kinship in a group of friends who shared like a lot of conflict, like a lot of people, you know, they'd lost people in their lives. Some quite literally had lost people to violence and whatever else. And they were risk takers and adventurers. And we bonded really quickly. And we did senseless things that, you know, got us nicked many times over. And our exploits got bigger and more daring. And we got closer and closer through those exploits. And until the day we got caught. You know, and at 17, I was arrested, charged, and convicted of the crime of conspiracy to steal. I think that's what they still call it, from a department store in London. And some people, when they hear that for the first time, are like, what did you do? Did you raid the store? Did you hide things under your coat? It was actually a pretty sophisticated crime for a bunch of kids. We were, you know, you have to consider we're 17. This is the year 2000, 2001, that time period. We stole around 20,000-30,000 pounds worth of merchandise from this department store by using cloning credit cards. You know, we have kids back then who grew up on council estates, which are projects here in the United States, and they could take the black metallic strip on the back of your credit card, which at that time was on in the back of library cards, Blockbuster cards, if people still had them. and one of the kids could program the card details of any card onto those strips. And we kept doing that until we got caught on the fifth occasion at that same department store. And I knew we were in trouble, but I didn't really know how much. You know, even the morning of sentencing, I didn't believe they were going to send a bunch of kids to prison, because it was the first offense, if I'm being very honest with everyone listening, which I believe in, it was the first offense we got caught for, obviously. I was honest with the police. We pleaded guilty and we accepted responsibility. We were ready to be punished, but did I believe we were going to prison? I guess not. And I don't remember anything the judge said except that we were being sentenced to 1 year in prison. And it was like an out-of-body experience, because the next thing I remember is in the cell below the court. And later that night, once we eventually got to what is Feltham Young Offenders Institute, which is like a Rikers for young people, even though they do house young people at Rikers, but it's solely for young people in London. Feltham Young Offenders is one of the most violent prisons in the UK. And once we got there, that's when they, as a lot of people who are listening and have been through the justice system know, they strip your identity. They took our personal belongings. They issue you with the standard dress code. They processed us, gave us numbers, and called you by your surname. And I remember one thing, before the guard closed that door that night, I looked in that room and I saw just, two tiny bars of soap, plastic comb, I think still two packets of Colgate. I can't remember exactly there. But on the and the bed on the bed there was a pillow and a duvet, but the cell was profoundly cold and depressing. And I think the guard said to me, "The next time you'll be out is at breakfast," and slammed the door. And at this point, I've been stripped of my identity and freedom. And I sat down on my edge of my bed and I began to cry. And it was the last time I could be vulnerable. I knew the moment I'd stopped, I'd be a different person. I call it instinct, but I learned to shut down all my emotions and feelings while in prison, because I knew that's what I needed to be to survive, which wasn't me. I didn't sleep. The next thing I remember was the door opening that morning, and it's the first time I saw my fellow detainees. And when I look back now, I see children, mostly Black and Asian, working class. And we experienced everything in prison, from humiliations to beatings to, older prisoners being set on younger ones by so-called prison officers, food taken away for a couple of days, they handcuff young people, and make racist remarks to them, just trying to go to reaction, frankly. And I was even put in solitary confinement for a short stint for my own protection. The same solitary confinement that, where people have lost their life. And that was for my own protection. And, I think I'm speak preaching to the converted here, that prison was never created to make us reform or stop recidivism. It was just made it was created to make us suffer. And my life transformed because of a one person program. My aunt in the UK, she fought for me. And you got to remember, you remember this time. I mean, early 2000s, late 90s was still a tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime era for a lot of people.
In some
And
ways, it is again.
it is,
So
it is, it's
we've
come
come
full
full
circle.
circle.
And she basically fought the Justice Department in the UK to let me do my exams that I was supposed to be taking on the outside inside, as my same time as my classmates. She fought the facility to make sure, even though that was granted, Josh, you're going to love this, the warden wouldn't let me have books. So she had to fight the warden to get the materials that I could study for those exams. And then she fought to make sure I was out earlier than my actual release date, because she knew every day I was in prison, there was an opportunity for something bad to happen. And on my release, she and my grandparents gave me a real sense of agency and a safe space to go home where I was loved and supported. And look, I know there were still potential obstacles. I finished studying, but I knew the stigma of my record would be over me for a long time. Would employers want to talk to me? Would people want to engage with me, even though we're out and enjoy our freedom? And we're fortunate. You're not really free. You're kind of halfway home, and you got to carry that judgment for the rest of your life. And it was only by a great opportunity that was provided to me by my grandfather introducing me to a at a at a book launch to an editor of a Fleet Street newspaper. Fleet Street's like a short name for all the newspapers in the UK. He was the editor of the News of the World and the Sun. And, he introduced me and said, "Look, my grandson's come out of prison and he's looking to transform his life." And the editor never asked me what I did. And look, I'm not stupid. He could find out, and I'm sure he did check. But he just wanted to know what I wanted to do with my life. And he saw, I think, a grafter. He saw a hustler. He saw someone who would always get the job done for him, and with a little mischief. It was a tabloid, right? A little mischief. And he saw my life experience, all of it, as a positive rather than a negative. And more importantly, he saw me. And thanks to him, I had a career in British and American politics, where I got to work alongside some of those, I would argue now, like, not so good bosses: Boris Johnson, Tony Blair, Joe Biden. That individual put his faith in me and transformed my life. And that's, you asked how I got to where I got to. If I didn't get that first opportunity, to work at News Corp and then to go work for the Conservatives after that, I wouldn't be here today talking to you as the global CMO of an agency in the United States, because that transformational moment was given to me by that individual.
I think many people like see someone like me or like yourself, much more probably you than me, and say, well, prison's terrible, but you all succeeded, so it must be doing something right. What's your kind of take on that? I have my own, but.
Prison didn't succeed in breaking me, and that's because of the love of a lot of people and protection of a lot of people. And even on release, even if you have all that, the perpetual punishment, I mean, we're both working on stuff like clean slate, which we can talk about, but the perpetual punishment was taken away because somebody with power gave me an opportunity and then was almost like my sponsor through my life. So it took the good graces of individuals and people, I believe in people, but it shouldn't take, we shouldn't be relying on it, single individual acts of goodwill so you can succeed in life after serving your time. I don't believe in prisons, I believe in abolition. But even if you do believe in prison, a lot of people believe that when you served your time, you should end there, but it never ends for people who've experienced that. And the only reason I've not suffered that perpetual punishment in terms of how it impacted my job or like other prospects around me there was because of somebody's goodwill.
So, you talk about being incarcerated in the United Kingdom and how it's somewhat similar in many ways and in some ways harsher, although, I find it hard to imagine anywhere harsher than some of our prisons, Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina, Louisiana, Mississippi, etc. But, it sounds like it's similar. You believe, I think, that mass incarceration to some extent is a British import. Is that, do I have that right? Am I getting that right?
I mean, look, people ask me why is Britain so punitive. Well, the British exported the model of state violence. Just think about the empire. It just happens to be wrapped in a velvet glove, right? That, the Brits used concentration camps. They used to, they legalized sacking civilian property. They, similar to what we do with legalizing taking property from people who've been incarcerated, they introduced solitary confinement in a lot of their territories. They enacted laws that allowed detention without trial. They instituted bail way back when there was an empire. And people talk about like Britain having a good impact on the world with an empire. I mean, no empire has any good impact in the world, but these were all state-sponsored acts, and we happen to use a lot of them on people who are incarcerated pre-trial and those convicted during those convicted now in the same way they were using it in the 1800s, and those people were subjected to remand without court dates, locked up in prisons for 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours without any outside light. These were all done under an empire, and America didn't invent this. It was definitely something maybe we pro I hate to say they've made it a model that shouldn't be copied, and maybe made it more brutal, but brutality is in the moment, right? So I'm sure people in India or Kenya or South Africa or anywhere else that's colonized, I'm sure their treatment wasn't was probably, given they don't have as much coverage or much protections, was probably more brutal than what we see today in our prisons, frankly. I mean, they had a concentration camp in South Africa, the British Empire. So evidently, we're not the only, we're the only ones who've done this. They just did it with a velvet glove of the empire did lots of good for the world.
Unless, of course, your country was one of the ones that was self-determination was ripped away from you, but for good things, I guess, like goods and services. We are starting to move kind of slowly towards harm reduction in the United States, but we're still kind of caught in a trap between pushing for, the answer to drugs is enforcement on one side and trying kind of new ideas like, harm reduction and, safe needle exchanges and testing your drugs on the other. You say it's even harsher in some ways in the United Kingdom. I don't get to talk to many people about other systems. What should people know about kind of the way things are happening in Britain?
I mean, weed's basically a class A drug in the UK. I mean, it's like top tier. I mean, we're talking about legalizing it. I mean, New York State, right? So it just legalized it and we're going to be selling it. And New Jersey started selling it last week. And
And
it's
Michigan sells it, and you
Michigan.
can,
And a lot of states it's legal. Look, it doesn't stop for the fact that President Biden hasn't kept a campaign promise of forgiving 40,000 people who are in jail for marijuana or
Man, it was a
prison.
huge part of his. I don't know if you've ever, I'm sure you have, but he had a very large criminal justice reform thing, and that was a big chunk of it. So, yeah.
And he made that promise because he knew, I mean, the tides are turning, right? I mean, like, this is something that is now becoming taxable and makes people a lot of money. So it makes no sense that he hasn't done that already with his pen. But that aside for a second, in the UK, we're not even in the conversation of legalizing weed. You know, we're not even in the
Wow.
conversation of, you know, it's still like if you're pulled over and you're caught with that, you're going to jail. Like there is no, and it's a countrywide
It's not
policy.
even a ticket. It's straight up, you're going to jail.
You are going to jail, right? So that is when you think about where the UK is. I mean, I'll give you a perspective. Like, you know, we during the Black Lives Matter movement and everything that happened during the pandemic, you know, the UK, the US, you know, there was a conversation. Look, how much did we get out of it? Still to be determined. You know, there's lots of bills being passed for people who've been doing this work as long as you have, or other people in our circle. There has been a lot of transformation over the last couple of years. You know, if you given that we started that work 20 years ago, right, or 10 years ago, just there's been a lot more good to come out of it. We still have a long way to go. But in the UK, in the middle of this pandemic, they, with popular support, spent 2.5 billion on prisons, on building more prisons to create 10,000 additional prison places. And they already have the highest prison population in Europe, right? And again, I'm not comparing, I'm not saying like our system here is barbaric. I'm just saying that, and it's a humanitarian crisis, but you know, they full on made that a thing to celebrate. Like a lot of our states just do this, you know, behind the scenes. We don't talk about it. I mean, I very rarely see coverage of new prisons being built, even though I know they do happen. They can, you know, the Conservative Party in the UK made a point of championing that policy. They also had people on 24-hour lockdown. Almost, they created solitary for every prison cell during the pandemic to keep them safe instead of releasing them. At least some states here were releasing people under the CARES Act and other things. People were being released. Not again, lots of prisons and jails still didn't do that here, but across the board, the UK didn't do any of that. You know, and you know, for people who've experienced solitary, I mean, that's pain. And these are people who, you know, solitary is obviously used as another form of punishment. These people had already been punished by being in prison, but now you're actually putting the whole prison system into solitary through a pandemic. The mental damage that's done to people is, I don't know, we're not going to see the toll of that for years.
So, I mean, we're obviously struggling here in a lot of ways with these problems. We've certainly not solved any of these problems. If anything, in many ways, we're making them worse. You know, you're talking about it potentially being as bad or close in Britain. How, I mean, I guess I want to start by saying, just like from a policy perspective, what are ways that this kind of, you know, long relationship we've had between our countries, could we do something to create energy in both places, I guess? Do you have any kind of vision of, you know, not just reform here, but reform everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is we're seeing a lot of cross-country collaboration on issues like the death penalty already, right? So there's people doing work on abolishing it globally, right? I think to use a celebrity name, Sir Richard Branson's been campaigning about it globally, right? He's trying to end there's someone being hopefully not being put to death at the end of the week in Singapore. And he's also helping support efforts from our community to stop someone in San Antonio, I think, being put to death this week or tonight. Or, and I think that's a powerful topic. But I think when
The
you
good news, I think that there was a stay, is my
amazing.
understanding. So I
That's a
think I read
blessing.
that earlier. So that's,
That's a
yeah.
blessing. And that truly is a blessing. And I hope that
Especially when it comes to Texas, because Texas, I mean, Governor Abbott's already overseen 55 executions is the time he's in governor, been governor. So.
And it's insane that we're still killing people today for crimes instead of like thinking about what got people there in the first place. Not looking at those underlying problems. We spend so much money on so many other things, and we're not dealing with it. But to your point about the original question, which was how can we just we're already doing it on the death penalty. There is a global movement along businesses and people to stop the death penalty, and that's a really like harsh one. So people, I think, can naturally mobilize around something like that. But when you think about weed. and drugs, and how some of this stuff is being legalized in multiple countries simultaneously, that you can expand that effort to decarcerate people who've been persecuted for doing that in previous times when it wasn't legal. You can mobilize around things like safe substance use in countries that are already trying to deal with those issues of addiction and opioids and everything else that goes with that as well. There are issues where countries, no matter where they are, might have a slightly different entry point, but we can get a cross-country, cross-continental collaboration on those things. I'm not going to say they're going to do everything we want to do, right? I mean, all those things we talked about that I've campaigned, you've campaigned on, are the UK going to do that, or any other country going to ban those things? I don't know. I think, but if the US does it, I think the US still leads, especially Western Europe. Like, if the US does some of this stuff, you know, the Europe looks at that and what will follow in some cases, you know, and you know, everyone talks about humane prisons coming out of Norway and Sweden, and you know, they're like college campuses, except that you have a fence, and we should copy those. Well, okay, fine, we can learn from those, but there is a lot of bigger European countries that are like the UK, Germany, France, they're still really punitive, and but they do follow what we do. They are going to end up legalizing things like weed. They are going to do the things that we do here in the United States. One, because it's a business opportunity and they don't want to be left behind, but two, you know, they're going to see mobilization of people who want individuals who are incarcerated or have records for that in the past to be freed in their own countries as well. The same way that you've seen it here, because so many people have been impacted by that. I think just even in the UK, I think something like 60%. You have to correct me. I'll send this after you, but I think 60% of all stop and searches are for weed in the UK, or they say they're for weed, but they're not. Like, they're just a stop and search and harass people of color, but they say they are for those things. And if you eliminated that, you know, and these are like really small amounts, by the way, that they find. If you eliminate that, you're going to dramatically impact who gets incarcerated and who doesn't already. So I think we set the tone potentially for a lot of big Western European countries.
So
they're not that progressive, by the way. I just want to just tell us, everyone's like, oh, Europe's so liberal and everything else. But you have to understand, when we think about Europe being liberal, we think about free education and free healthcare, right? Do you know why we have those things in Europe? Because the continent was leveled after World War II. So governments had to give people free healthcare. They had no choice. So like, they had to give people access to free education. They had no choice. These public sector things were built to help a continent recover from a colossal event. Like, doesn't mean all the rest of the policies are progressive. They're as punitive as us.
So we talk a lot, I think, in our, what if it's an industry, whatever it is that we do, about changing the narrative. And you work, a lot of your work has been kind of in this area. And you started out in tabloid journalism, as you mentioned a second ago. I don't know if you've seen this movie or not. Have you ever seen the movie Sid and Nancy?
No, I haven't.
Well, I'm an old punk rock guy. So there's a movie called Sid and Nancy. It's about, you know, the Sex Pistols, the bass player, Sid Vicious, and his girlfriend, Nancy Spungen. And one of the premises of that movie, like if there's a central premise of that movie, and it's odd to tie kind of our current cultural situation back to a movie about Sid Vicious, but I think there's something here. The central premise of that movie in a lot of ways is Malcolm McLaren saying that no matter what music the band made, no matter what anyone did in that band, that the real star of the Sex Pistols was the image of Sid Vicious. It was just his, you know, him creatively being destructive. And I feel like something about that is like a virus that's infected our politics. And I feel like everything that anyone says now has a part of that kind of creative destructiveness. When you look at Twitter, when you look at whatever, when you look at all these, what I would call performance artists now, a lot of what they're doing is being that kind of, you could say anarchist, but I'd say to some extent nihilist. And so in your experience, like, you were right up front for a lot of the growth of this kind of, I don't even know how to say what's come out of kind of, I think all press is to some extent become tabloid press.
Yes.
So you're sitting at you're in the front of that revolution. What are your reflections on that before we put it in context of criminal justice or anything else? I just think this is one of the few times I'll be able to ask someone who is like kind of there for the whole. I don't
I
know if that
think
was too long of a question or if it
no.
made sense, but.
You asked me something. I think it's actually the perfect way to ask. I think I'm going to reflect my mentor, who was that editor for one of the most powerful newspapers in the world at the time, and one of the powerful tabloids in the world. And he used to say, "We don't set the tone. We reflect what people want. We reflect their hunger." I think it's what we need to look at our society also a little bit. And what it strives for. So when you think of tabloids, you think about how tabloids build people up, they knock people down. People love that journey, that story, that pain. But on the whole, tabloids made more from the disaster part of that, the sensationalism part of that, than anything else. Tabloids paid cops for stories, and not and this is not a secret,
That's what happened to Piers Morgan the first time, right? Wasn't that what he got in trouble for?
You got phone hacking and so many other things, right? So I'm not going to say name, I'm not going to name names, but many of my peer group who were my seniors had very good relations with cops on both sides of the pond. Those stories that you see in the Post today and everything else about since cops are making money off that. And it might not always be cash. It's sometimes tickets. It's sometimes whatever. That still happens. And we are turning a blind eye to that. The cops literally sell sensational headlines, sensational stories on individuals. And it might start with like your Hugh Grant's getting a blowjob in the back of a car, to, but it quickly gets into black kids being profiled or brown kids being called terrorist suspects before anyone's claimed a terrorist suspect because it's one of 70 million pictures on a wall on a cop station that they want to share. And cops get paid for that. That's insane that
Well, and
that's
even if they
okay.
don't get paid directly, ultimately that fuels their budget, and that's why they have media departments.
100%. I mean, the media departments is a separate issue completely, but they all started with that workaround. It's been going on from like the 80s, 90s, whatever, right? That's been going on for a long time. Now ads, the budgets for media departments. They are fully professionalized media departments who put out releases on everything now. They control the narrative. And they control it sickly because it's easy news. It's news that, as my mentor would say, is reflective of how society feel as well. And some of that's forced feeling. Over years, they're getting the same message. I mean, the TV that we watch sensationalizes the police and the criminal justice system. The movies we get makes them heroes, and most of them are incompetent at their jobs. So all that is a natural feeling inside people already, and the tabloids exploit that. And the media departments jump in with like, they don't even need to give correct figures because it's however they want to structure the data because they own the data. And that's the problem with that.
So you kind of, I understand it's a chicken and egg question, and I understand that some of it's society and some of it's the tabloids. But before the tabloids, we didn't have everything blowing up like it does now. So there is some relationship. I guess the question I'm asking is how much responsibility should the chicken bear?
How much should we bear as people?
No, no, no. Well, you can
Yeah.
whichever one, the chicken or the egg,
Yeah,
you know, I
okay.
mean, is it?
I mean, I
I
think,
guess I was considering the tabloid to be the chicken, but I guess it could be the egg. I don't.
I mean, I mean, I think they bear the majority of the responsibility. They're selling us lies, stories. They're trying to shape a narrative that we all should live in fear constantly, because it sells headlines, it sells newspapers, it sells, it's clickbait. Clickbait before even clickbait was ex existed in tabloids. So they know it makes the money. So they bear the most responsibility. But we do bear responsibility to not look at headlines and actually read and find out what's going on in our communities. The beautiful thing of social media is, yes, you're right. Most people have made it a nihilistic tool and like people are fighting there all the time. But also it is the reason some revolutionary things have happened in our society too, right? Now we I'll give you a good example. Last week, when those train, the unfortunate train shooting in New York, the cops claimed that they solved the crime. They caught the guy. But it was people on the street with
Oh, yeah.
social media who said, no, people did this. The cops were incompetent. In fact, this guy was walking on the streets and the cops missed him. It was people, New Yorkers, fucking proud New Yorkers, who actually called it in that this guy was here, come and get him. Now, look, again, we can talk about whether. What, how hopefully, the system, how he treats the individual. But the point being is they would sell that lie and turn cops into heroes, right? These guys stopped like all this thing, but it was people that did that. That's a really simple lie. But if you can lie about that, because their initial posts were all about how the cops did all the work, you can lie about anything, right? And that's a responsibility. There is a massive responsibility on the press to tell the truth. Unfortunately, we haven't got the press to do that. So people have got to take it upon themselves to find out what's going on, because our press, I think, is broken right now. Our press is, the most liberal institutions, the New York Times and Week Daily, they publish headlines about how crime rates are soaring, homicides are this, that, and no one is countering that in any
Well,
media
I wouldn't say
publication. No,
nobody.
but in any media, no, in any media publication, right? So if the New York Times is the progressive publication, then what is the
That's
Wall Street
such
Journal?
nonsense, though. I mean, whatever the thing that drives me nuts is when people call the New York Times a liberal paper. It's
No,
like
I
maybe 30 years ago.
30 years ago, 100, but that's the point, like, right? There was very few publications of that stature that are countering that point of view. It's not, I'm not saying people aren't doing it. Josh, you and me do it. We do it on social, we do, I publish stuff, you publish stuff. We're countering it, right? But
Yeah, but we
they're
don't have the microphone.
we don't have the mic. They have the mic, and they are, for good or bad, you mean they know they're not liberal or progressive, but for good or bad, they're seen as the progressive publication. And if they're seen to publish those headlines, they are influencing people potentially on our side of the debate that this things are out of control.
And so you talk about, the economics of it is one set of the problem. The other set is the problem is that you said ago that people would rather see, for instance, someone see a Real Housewife flip a table, then maybe they want to, go through a detailed article about why something happened. So how do we bridge that gap, I guess? We have the two questions. How can there be a more responsible, ethical, but profitable media? And on the other side, how can people become better consumers or more ethically responsible consumers of media?
Yeah, I think people, let's read history. Let's see what's going on in our country. The last couple of years has exposed people to a lot of things, and maybe people are exhausted. Let's start there, but you need to look into what's actually been going on in the history of this country and many other places that people come from, and you realize that it isn't, the state and the cops aren't always right, right? You have to also realize, do some critical thinking. We keep spending billions more on a institution that keeps failing us. Does that seem like rational spending? It's your money. You're the taxpayer. You wouldn't do this with any other department. You wouldn't do this in your business. If a department is failing, would you keep spending money on that department to get the same result, worse, worse, and worse? So I ask people to question their politicians, their local elected officials as well, and mayors and governors, tell them why they're spending money on something that's already broken. Because you could, the New York NYPD has a bigger budget than, I think, outside of six militaries in the world. They're like seventh biggest military budget in the world, and they can't stop crime. Clearly, it doesn't work. So people need to ask questions of their elected officials about what a waste of money that is. Now, on the journalism side of this, I don't have all the answers. I think we need to start forming our own publications to counter that narrative. I don't think they're vested. I think too much of the media is owned by too few people right now who have their own agenda, and they enjoy the nature of the product that they have right now, whether it's Rupert Murdoch and News Corp or even the guys at the New York Times. They know it makes sense to them. I don't know if they're going to ethically ever change. I would like to see them ethically change. I'd like to be held to a standard where they have to tell stats correctly. I mean, that should be a basic requirement of all media, frankly. And there are very few places that do that. And I think the government could regulate to make that, like, if government data shows this, you can't lie about that, right? That should be a fact. Like, the police can't give you data. You have to get that verified. That part would be amazing, but we need our own publications.
Well, but so just to push back a little bit. So there are some people we know who have publications. They've come out, they've tried to do things. There was the Peel for a while that it still exists technically, but it's not at the same level it was once. We have Bolts, which is the new, there
I
are
love
people
bots.
trying to do that, but people still read the Post a lot more than they read either of those places. How do we get How are we going to start getting people to read something different than the sensational? Like when every day the Post says you are going to die if you don't get rid of bail reform. How do we counter that? You I'm
News.
asking you
No,
because you
no.
did tabloid news, so
So
you know the
we create. We're often too serious. We talk about policy. We don't give people easy entry points to everything, right? Everybody can agree. A lot of like the defunded the police thing is a great example of this. You know, during the height of all that, I had to do. I did some right of center broadcasts that are associated with Fox and everything else, Sky News in the UK and everything else. And just put it really basic to people. You know, what does defunding the police look like? It looks like the Upper West Side. Yeah, I just said that to some people, and some people on the right get that. Like, you know, they get the tap. Like, I would rather spend my money on museums, schools, and parks than spend it on a bunch of guys carrying guns around my neighborhood. People got it. Like, we need to think like tablet. We need to make the entry points accessible to all people, because everybody has a different way of getting into a story. I actually think more Americans believe in radical reform of this stuff than they're given credit for. They just don't have the same entry point that some of those publications that I'm not criticizing them. They're just sometimes too serious. We need our own tabloid. We need our own tabloid that brings the police down. We need our own tabloid that brings the judicial system down. We need our own tabloid that tells stories as salaciously almost, or as an easier entry point as as they do to us, you
Yeah,
know?
I think we've actually talked about that before because we were talking about, I can't remember what his name is, but one of the alt-right guys created that whole media infrastructure for himself, and it's been incredibly, and I'm like, we need to, I think we both have said we need to be doing something like that, even if it kind of makes our skin crawl a little bit.
And weirdly, it doesn't. I mean, these individuals have destroyed communities, destroyed homes, destroyed families, destroyed so much of our society. And like, we're just going to tell their stories now, right? At the same time, tell good stories about our people. You know, we need our own tabloid. Like storytellers, we need people who do this in 300 words or less and tell you how bad the police are and what they've done and who they've hurt and you know what, you know, make their lives a living hell the way that they have made our communities' lives a living hell, like expose them for who they are. Now, I think there was something passed in the pandemic where you can get every cop's record, right? How many times they've been accused of racism, you know, assault, battery, you know, home abuse, whatever it is, right? Put it all out there in a tabloid and see how people start feeling about them. Put them on the front page. Put those cops and make their lives as painful as every black kid that gets profiled straight away when any incident happens, and see how quickly the narrative changes about who's heroes and who are community.
Interesting. So we've talked about the journalism part. You also worked in politics. I often look back in the United States to the Republican autopsy several decades ago when they suggested that maybe, just maybe, the GOP, given the demographic shift that's happening in the country, should maybe be a little less hostile towards the issue of black issues that black and brown people care about. And as a result, the GOP has spent the last 30 years trying to figure out how to beat the demographic shift instead of embrace that advice. That's my theory of the case. What do you think is going on since you've been, you've been with prime ministers, you've been with mayors, you've worked on big campaigns. What's kind of your theory of the case of what's going on?
With the current state in the United States or more globally, what's going on? I mean, like a bit of both, I think. You know, I think they've doubled down on everything. I think the interesting thing with the United States for me, as someone who comes from Europe where elections seem to be a bit more easy to figure out, is the electoral system is so broken here that they can mess with it. They've doubled down on a structure that allows them to eliminate so many people from the electoral register that makes it difficult to vote. By the way, we're not the only country doing that, right? So the UK tried to pass a voter ID record. Like the UK's never had IDs at polls ever in its life, but it's kind of replicating what the US is doing when Texas and Georgia and other places where they require like a passport effectively to vote, which is insane. Through my whole life, there's never been any fraud in the UK. Like there has been very little, if any, fraud here in the United States. So they're just doubling down and isolating. They're going all in on just trying to secure what they have now. And you know, I don't think anyone listening knows what the end game is here. It's just eliminating democracy. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, they tried to do it on Jan 6th, and I think they'll. If they got power again, I think our rights will be eroded very quickly. I don't think they have any intention of trying to reach out to other communities. When, by the way, it's really interesting to me when I think about the Republicans over the last 20 years, they could chip away at the Democrats' magical block, right? When you think of like religion, you know, when you think about Latino, Latinx people coming in like the country who are, you know, they're religious. They might not believe in abortion. I'm, you know, pro-choice, but there are lots of other touch points where they could access communities,
Well,
LGBTQ rights.
they are gaining ground in the Latinx community. They
Right.
definitely
No,
are. Yeah.
100, they are gaining, but it's not to, I think they made a bigger deal out of it at the last election that they took a tiny percentage away when they actually, you know, it's not, it wasn't that significant compared to the overall picture of the last election. And yes, they've gained a small bit of ground, but like they could do that with most, a lot of communities. They could actually put the work in, but they think the solution for them right now is to take away our democratic rights rather than actually appeal to a broad base of Americans.
It's certainly less work in a sense once you
Yeah, once you get the courts and everything else on your side, it makes it a lot easier to disenfranchise a lot of people.
unfortunately, we're seeing something happen in Democratic politics more than I'd say in progressive politics, but definitely in Democratic politics, Democratic Party politics, where the politicians, instead of like when they see this happening, I mean, to some extent they raise their hands and say, "Oh my God, this can't be happening."
Yeah.
But you know, when it, especially with our issue, when it comes to criminal justice, they're tripping over each other to agree with the other side. They're doing what used to be called during the Clinton era triangulation, only they don't have anything to triangulate. They're not saying, "Here's the issue we have a popular support on, and we're going to say that we agree with the Republicans on the rest of this stuff," which is what Clinton used to do. They're just saying we agree with it. We were never against. We were never soft on crime. We were never for criminal justice reform. We were never, you know. So, how can we win political battles, or how can we change this fight for democracy when politicians are almost conceding defeat before it's even started?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's watching, it's like they learned nothing from 2020 Democrat politicians. They only won the election because of the promises you alluded to earlier on. I mean, look, yes, did Trump turn out a massive vote for the Democrats too? Yes, you know, but you know, you like me saw Biden's platform. You know, there was a lot of promises, student loans, student college debt, wiping that away. You know, releasing everyone who's convicted of a marijuana crime, like getting rid of the death penalty, which the president can probably do very quickly. All these
At least at the
things
federal
at a
level,
federal
yeah.
level for sure, like, and making it kind of difficult for everyone to want to pursue it as well through courts as well. So he made, you know, let's just go back to how he won. Massive cities in states he needed to flip, predominantly minority driven cities won him that election, right? Promises were made to those individuals. And he's already broken all of them. And so the Democrat Party, those individuals, sadly, are not going to forget that. And it's, and I you know, they have beyond driven me mad. It's all superficial posturing when they say they care about communities and care about Black lives, or they care about immigrants and they care about all these things. But they literally, they always get their messaging wrong. I think about Pelosi and everyone recently, and I don't even know the way to describe this. They don't lean into what won them the election. They actually have support for what won them the election. Screw what the polls say, screw what the headline writers say. Just act on what you got elected on in the first place. You got elected on to transform our criminal justice system. You got elected on securing our right to vote. You got elected on getting rid of student debt. There are a lot of other things they got elected on, and they go back like a they just do a full U-turn because they see a few headlines. Guess what? They win. They just do the things you say you would win. And they're scared of how the media narrative will shape. And I think part of the problem is they're not public servants anymore. They are literally politicians just looking for re-election and that short stint. But they don't realize they're not going to turn those Republican voters in their direction ever. They've gone down, far too down a rabbit hole now to come back out. So they should appeal to the same broad base that actually got them elected in the first place on these big issues. Look, you need to be able to talk about what defunding the police looks like in a really simple way, like I described earlier on. Like, people really want to know. If you ask a normal citizen who has no connection to this issue, like the way you and me do, if you explain it to them about where you're going to spend the money, most people agree. Most people don't agree that the NYPD should have armored vehicles. like that you can use in Iraq and Syria and everywhere else in the world where the US deploys military. Most people think that's bonkers when you tell them how they spend your billions of dollars or how the corrections department's spending money. They would chip away at that and spend it on things that matter to the community. And I think most people are there, but the Democrats cave so easily because of a bad bunch of headlines that are basically written to make them change their opinion, that we don't have anyone who stands up to the for the issues that we actually care for. I mean, there are a handful that do, you know, and a handful I know that you work with and other individuals work with, but they are few and far between. They're the few public, true public servants that actually exist that want to help our country and our people, not just the sense of them getting reelected.
And, I mean, an example of what we're talking about here, like one of the things that really frustrates me is I think a lot of times I see on the left as much of a desire for a strong person, tough leader, as there is on the right. You see what's happening with the kind, the lionization of Cuomo is now becoming, at least in certain media circles, the lionization of Adams. With, and in both cases, that's pretty problematic. Obviously Cuomo didn't turn out to be a great investment as the great savior of Democratic politics. And the point is that they keep picking these people because they're gonna be the thing that wins the undecided and moderate right back, and not win or excite the rest of the base,
Look,
which is
America.
the thing that's winning. There's this great book. It'll come to me in a second what the title of it is, but it's the book that they actually teach seminars on across the country on the alt-right about politics, and they say it's not about anything aside from exciting your base. I mean, that the only thing that matters is exciting your base and doing the thing, the red meat.
Look,
And
America is already in that danger of becoming the cult of toughness. You know that. You and me both know that. Like, it's there, and there's no value. To me, there's no value in stripping someone's dignity. And we should all be uniting against like those individuals that they're lionizing right now, because there's so much danger involved in that cult of toughness that suddenly gets turned on all people. It doesn't get turned on just people who are criminals or quote unquote like bad apples or bad people. This gets turned on all citizens eventually, and that's the dangerous, whether Democrats or Republicans. So that cult of toughness is a scary thing. I mean, it's Vladimir Putin. It's all those things. When you want a tough leader to just hurt people because that makes you feel safe, you're opening that door up for you. And I'll tell you, to someone who I did foreign policy back home when I worked for Blair, right? Someone once said to me, who resigned from Labour Party, who was a former foreign secretary, all the things we're doing abroad will come home to roost, right? And I never really understood what he meant during that period of Iraq, Afghanistan, and everything else exactly, except the fact that, people would attack the UK. But he meant the drones. He meant the technology, the surveillance. He meant the monitoring. He meant the stripping of rights that we do abroad. How many people do we kill with drones? Do you know the NYPD uses drones now? They monitor us with drones. They follow us around. Your police, anyone listening, your police is using military tech to follow you around, to surveil you, every average normal citizen. And you might say, I have nothing to hide, but do you want someone following you around? Do you want drones above our city all day and
people
night?
always mess this up, though. It's not that you have nothing to hide. It's that things that you do can be used against you
Against
in
you.
ways you didn't anticipate.
And you can't
Like,
control.
for instance, if you donated to someone who later you didn't want everyone to know about it, someone says, "Well, I'll tell everyone you donated if you don't X." It's these little things that we do that we consider private space. It's not that you're doing something criminal necessarily that makes surveillance dangerous. It's that every element of your life can be used against you by nefarious people at nefarious times.
Yeah, and all the technology that we've been using abroad during these war and terror years have come home to us. All the policies about locking people up in rendition and incarcerating people without trial have come home to roost as well, both in the UK and the US. And that will eventually be used against every citizen if we're not careful. So we need to break out this cult of toughness and actually give
Well,
solutions
and
that will
let's
actually help
not,
community.
you said that this was just one example of it, but if you think about it, I think on purpose, Putin couched most of his Ukraine invasion in the same language we used for Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And the reason he did it was because we had already said that was okay,
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah, we already used that, and that's why the UN can't intervene. We already basically, I mean, this is going off topic, but we broke the UN with
Sorry.
Iraq. Yeah. We broke the UN with Iraq. You know, we basically said that doesn't matter. And he used exactly the same language to invade Ukraine. It's only just the strength of mobilization in Europe and a lot of the Western world that they've seen so much war in the in Europe in the past that they've rallied around that country. Otherwise, we would have taken it, you know, Putin would have gone all in by now.
Yeah, so you've worked with a lot of the of actual, you know, we talked about Boris Johnson, Tony Blair, Joe Biden. I'm kind of skeptical of the whole, I've always been to some extent skeptical of the whole idea that one or two people should be making the decisions for everybody. And this is really a model we should, you know, I guess it's better than monarchy where everyone gets to do it by divine right.
Yeah.
But, I like studying presidents and stuff like that, but I'm not sure it's necessarily the best thing we can come up with. But nonetheless, you've worked with a lot of these folks. What's kind of your takeaway, as you mentioned, we're having a lot of problems with Joe Biden living up to his, and some of that's because his people are probably telling him that there's no political gain to have from it. How do we change? How do we talk to someone like that who you at least know? How do we change the narrative on with people in power like that?
Well, in his case, it's just remind. I think we need to get him back to what reminded him who got elected, how he got elected, because I think he is going to try and run again, right? So he actually needs to realize that he needs to mobilize that force. But this time, I don't think they're going to. He might have a bigger problem getting them to turn out this time without keeping some of those promises that he's made before he got elected in 2020, right? So he needs to be reminded of that. He's reminded, and if he keeps him and some of the Democrat leadership. Still keep saying things like Black Lives Matter and everything else. And you've got to remind them that if Black Lives Matter, you've got to talk about the issues that actually save communities. We're not talking about just, you know, throwing a few dollars into HUD and everything like that. We're talking about issues that impact 70 million Americans, you know, of all colors and creeds, but like you, which predominantly impact Black Americans. So, you know, when you think about that, how, if he expects to get that base out to vote this time again, it's a lost cause. It's a lost cause for the Democrat Party. And they might, it might be too late for the midterms for them because they actually just, you know, you and me have discussed this offline. Like they've just gone down such a dark hole of like put more on anything police, you know, make everything on the border, you know, tight like the Republicans want, whatever else, right? They've gone down that path already. It might be too late for the midterms. But if they actually want to have a successful next presidential election, they have to keep those promises. They have to actually act on those things that they got elected. They got elected on compassion, care. They got elected on, that's what Biden got elected on. You know, like he wasn't Trump. He got elected on, I'm that guy who, you know, he famously said, you know, as someone who's received a lot of compassion for the loss I've actually suffered, it's not that difficult to offer that to other people. Well, he's not offering it to people who are incarcerated. He's not offering it for people who still are dealing with the ramifications of a pandemic the way that he promised he would. That compassion, that lovable Joe who hugs people who've been victims of gun violence at things like Parkland and everything else. Where is that on these issues that matter to the communities that got you elected?
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. But then, I know, and I think maybe you do too, his criminal justice folks, they're good people. Some of them I knew before they were in the administration, and they agree with a lot of the stuff that we agree with, but it's still not getting through. So what's going wrong here? Like who what's the problem,
I mean, there's two schools of looking at it, and I'm kind of like flipping a coin on it. Either the old man didn't change, and he still is the father of mass incarceration from the 90s, which is a possibility. I
It
don't want
is,
people
sir.
to people don't. Some people don't want to hear that. Some Democrats will hit me up for saying that. Maybe he didn't change. Maybe it was all an act. But also, his inner circle is not the right circle. Yeah, Ron Klain, these individuals, they come from an era that does believe in that sort of stuff. So he's not hearing what he needs to hear from people like his criminal justice advisors, people like us, and people closest to the problem because his inner circle is so stuck in the past on these policies that he can't move on it. And they're giving him the advice that you're talking about, where they're like, it's just a political suicide when it's really not. You know, he would win those big cities that would flip those states in a without a doubt, or any Democrat running in 2024 if they actually lean into the policies that got them elected in 2020.
I mean, you have to do something that excites people.
Yes.
I
And
mean, the one thing you could say a lot about Trump, but his people are endlessly excited by him. You know, and he knows it and he plays to that. I don't know what, if you go up to Democrats, ask them what they're excited about. I don't know. You know, there's got to be, you have to do something. You know, yes, they passed the infrastructure. Yes, they got everyone vaccinated. They don't ever talk about it, but those things happen. You got to excite the people that are your base with something. You know, I mean, you can't just play it safe. That's not the way it works.
Okay, I think it's the same thing about the tabloids that we talked earlier on, all right? They're just not, they're kind of spineless. I mean, look, if you want to talk about dealing with the pandemic earlier on, right? When he came into office, he had all the goodwill in the world, right? Make flying domestically a vaccinated only thing. Watch how many vaccine-resistant individuals would have got vaccinated if they actually had to get one to get on a flight domestically. Forget international. You know, he had all the goodwill in the world. And he wasted it at the beginning on trying to appease people who were not, you know, who were never going to vote for him. Trying to make peace with individuals that brought down the last Democrat president by restricting his ability to do anything in his second term, which, by the way, he calls his friends like Mitch McConnell and all these individuals. I think they spent their whole time trying to undermine the whole Obama administration. Yet he's like, oh, I want to work with them. I mean, like, why are we trying to appease people who already took down someone you call your brother, you know, someone you show a lot of affection to, and you want to actually work with these individuals again? You, at that point, you had all that goodwill, should have gone in there and gone at things hard with, and I think the issue is, I think they're just spineless. They're scared to lose they're scared to lose tabloids that don't want them to win anyway. The tabloids like the other side. They love the controversy. And I think the difference between, look, and you know, obviously Trump abused his office, but I do think there are leaders who know how to use the office and some people who don't know how to do it. We play by the rules, but the rules aren't, a lot of them are handshake rules. They're not actually like legislative laws. You actually can do a lot with the power of the presidency. And I think our presidents have been pretty cowardice on that stuff in the past. Our leaders on the Democrat side are spineless. I think they always want to play the fair game, and the other side doesn't give a shit. And that's what excites the other side. Like Trump, for all his flaws, knew how to use the power of the office. Forget the overturning of elections and stuff like that, which I think he should never be allowed to run. He should be in jail for those crimes of treason. But the point being that, like, at least at a really basic level, he knew how to use the office or the office properly. Joe Biden could do a lot of his promises without Congress. He could do them tomorrow. To your point about exciting people, clemency, he could excite people. Freeing people who've been locked up with marijuana charges, he could excite people. Freeing people who are elderly, who've served 20, 30, 40, 50 years, who are no threat to society, he could win lots of hearts and minds with that. He could restore communities and restore cities and restore towns across this country. People who've lost generations to previous policies that we all agree now have been too harsh on people. And on the student thing, he could wipe it away with a pe he could wipe it away with his pen tomorrow. He could do all of that, but I just think he lacks the spine to do it. And I think the Democrats lack the spine to do it. And the people who are calling from it are on the outside, like Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, and everything. I don't think they're on the inside. They're not close enough to the president or his advisors to make it happen.
Yeah, I feel bad for Bernie, man. He's carried a lot of water over the last couple of years that he just doesn't ever get to drink, you know?
Hey there.
My friend Amanda Alexander always talks about the power of dreaming big and of having freedom dreams. You know, so one of the things I'm asking lately is, you know, we've talked a lot about all the problems with the system. We've even talked about creating our own tabloid, which I think is an excellent idea. But what are some ideas, what's some dreams that you have about changing our system? You know, our system.
Dreams. I mean, obviously, like you, I don't, you know, like a lot of people who are very close to me, I don't believe in the prisons. So I'd like to see them abolished, and we can figure out better ways to deal with problems in our society. And, you know, that means moving that money from where it's going to now to actually investing in people long term. But, you know, I think the biggest thing on my, the biggest dream is getting clean slate passed nationally, something that you've worked on in Michigan, something that I really believe in. I think we can all, listening to this, agree that after 2 years and a bit of this pandemic, I think our country deserves a clean slate. We all deserve a fresh start. And I think for me, I think that would be a great way for us to get back out of this fucking cycle of hate, sorry, and prejudice and judgment, and just start again, you know? And I think that, to me, if we can pass it in all the states that are trying to do it right now, New York and other places, and actually even pass it on a federal level, that'd be beautiful. You know, there's 70 million Americans impacted by that. That means probably you know that person. If you're not directly impacted by this issue, you know someone who is. You know someone who is, by association, a relative, a friend, someone who not told you. It's something that would reset this country for the good, not for bad.
I mean, one thing I always say is that, for the first, since we passed it in Michigan, that, in April of 2023, when automatic comes in, there are going to be up to 1 million people in our state who, for the first time in their lifetimes, well, in their adult, in a long time, are going to be able to walk into a apartment complex and not worry about being turned away because of their record. Their first time they're going to be able to walk into an employer and not worry about having to check that box, because automatically they woke up that morning and their, old 4 year, 7 year, 10 year old offense just disappeared, from the public record. I mean, there's still a private record of it, but I mean, these are the kind of things that, like you're saying, it's a powerful message that you can. It's one of the things that no matter where everybody feels about it, if someone is desisted from crime for enough of a time for it to matter, why wouldn't you be? Why is it? This just seems like a message that we should be pushing across the country.
Look, I've been blessed, because of my training as journalist. I've always been a storyteller from my time as a journalist to working in politics and comms. And now I believe you can heal through storytelling, bring joy through storytelling, bring information and enlightenment through storytelling. And that's why I'm here. But I also think Democrats need to take a page out of that book. There's so much healing and joy that they can bring to counter the narrative of hate that comes from the other side, but also the tabloids and our media institutions and how they frame communities, people, and individuals that will really unify this country in a way that they don't, that they just can't get out of their single track mind of doing right now.
Is there anything else you're working on that you think that you're excited about?
I mean, clean state's the big one, obviously. I mean, if it passes in New York, that'd be amazing. It's going to impact so many people personally, I know. And I think for me also, as someone who was raised by my grandparents and my aunt, I think one of the big things that really is important to me is passing this elder justice parole justice bill that's up in New York. I forgot the name, sorry, it's just slipped my mind. A RAP, basically, which allows people to be released who've are genuinely no threat to society and served ridiculously long sentences for their crimes, some political prisoners there, so they can spend their years with their community and their loved ones. I think it's a really great way to heal. And I think we need to get there with that. Some things I'm working on personally, is a lot of second chance hiring initiatives. I've built my own programs in the UK, but I'm, obviously working at RGA right now, and, trying to get the whole ad industry to really get people, look, here's the thing I always say to people, all the cool things you see on TV, they are taken from the street. Like those advertising guys didn't come up with it. Like their culture, they just get paid to do it. And, society happens to always either kill us if you're a community of color or make a killing from us and our ideas. And, getting our industry to hire more people who have been impacted is really important to me. Also, they are the culture. They are like the culture, they're the fashion, they're everything. So frankly, those individuals are would light up that industry in a way they'd never seen before. And
Yeah, there's a great book on the shelf behind me called Where It's At, which is a story. The whole premise of that book is that the most powerful cultural influence in the world is hip hop, and that it runs it that nothing runs the world like hip hop.
And I think we forget that really easily in that corporate world. But I think to leave it on that, I think the interesting thing for me is like, we've been talking about politicians a lot, we've been talking about the tabloids a lot, but business plays a big role in this too, right? So, designing a more human future has to start with our people. I think, when you think about a human-led approach to everything, I believe businesses can influence the wider culture and society as well by creating that powerful new narrative, because it's our responsibility, at least in my industry as a creative industry, to question what ideas and values we're disseminating, what stereotypes or biases we're introducing, and to whom we're giving platforms to through our work. Creating a new narrative really begins with questioning our past, examining the narrative that we built. Remember, the war on drugs was something that the ad industry helped the president at the time, Reagan, do. We've built a narrative that has hurt people and harmed people. It's essential that we find solutions to our problems now and amplify voices that should be, so we can transform that. And the conventional corporate marketing model, needs to be disruptive. The typical model doesn't recognize social issues, issues orientated around justice or equity. These issues are not going away, and as advertisers and marketing leaders or other business leaders, we need to start playing a more active role on the right side of history. By doing right by society, by doing right by people, we have an opportunity to influence culture well beyond clients or our industries. And I think the interesting thing is our own people, our own staff, the people that work for these companies, whether it's JP Morgan or RGA or any other place out there, they want to do it, right? So the business leaders will not have a choice in the end to mobilize around these issues as well.
So one thing although I've gone way off topic a
Yeah.
bunch of times today, one thing I've been trying to do is get a little bit broader with folks and ask if they have any hobbies that people might not know about.
Oh, I have a slight obsession with David Bowie. You might see this photo behind me. My dad has every original record of David Bowie's first edition print, so I collect them. And it's he has a beautiful saying that is, I don't know where I'm going from here, but I know it won't be boring. And I feel like that's symbolic of my life. And he's the first person that really transformed, and Prince to a degree, kind of took away that need to be masculine for men, right? You are who
Yeah, I
you
think for me
are.
it's David Bowie, Prince, and Robert Smith were
Yes.
the three people that did that for me.
And he just, they were just who they are. And I think that's such an empowering place to be in the world, when you can live who you really are in the world. And it's a great influence that's had on me. I collect all his records on vinyl, have them all. I have a huge vinyl collection in general, and it's something that I'm really proud of. And it's my little hobby, that music collection.
I kind of got into Bowie in an odd way because I was more of a punk kid. And so I actually got into Bowie because of Bauhaus covering Bowie and then went back through and started getting into Bowie after that. Even though Bowie had been very influential in punk and a lot of the post-punk stuff, I didn't know that until I made the full circle.
But yeah, it's
Because
interesting. I mean,
he was really influential with with Devo and a bunch of other, of the post-punk, especially the British post-punk, but also the American post-punk
but even
stuff.
though
So.
if you think about the Let's Dance album era, like while people think that's very poppy and everything else, I mean, think of the producers like Nile Rodgers, like all the underlying bass in it, all the they he had punk people, he had R&B people, he had all those individuals produce what people regard as pop today. But if you listen to the music, if you take it apart, it's amazing. Like it's
No.
phenomenal music of its time. So yeah, very and just music. It's my hobby collecting original vinyls now. So from to your point about Brits, Depeche Mode to
Yeah.
Michael Jackson, I have all his original singles. Like I
I
take
was an Echo and the Bunnymen guy, but
that. The Smiths, like
Oh yeah,
the
like the
Smiths.
Smiths,
And a lot of people like Marvin Gaye and everything else. We had Melvin Harrell's a really big favorite, a big fan of him. No, Harold Melvin, sorry, Harold Melvin. Just collecting all that stuff is my hobby.
All right, we covered records, so now I always ask if there's any criminal justice related books that you like or might recommend to our listeners.
Well, I'm reading Halfway Home by Reuben Miller. That's I'm going to recommend it regardless, because Reuben's a great man. So I want to put his book out there and say we should read it. I mean, I think you've got some of the best behind you right now from Just Mercy and everything else. But Reuben's new book is eye-opening. It's beautifully written. From the I'm only halfway through it, but it's a beautiful read. So I
Yeah, you can
recommend it.
definitely tell I like Ruben. He's been on the podcast
Great man. And
Yeah.
I think we need people to tell more stories like that. I mean, it goes back to storytelling. I mean, I think he's doing it through he's giving people access. It's an easy read.
It
It's not
is, yeah.
policy. It's an easy read. And I think that's what we need more of in the world.
I always ask the same last question. What did I mess up? What question should I have asked but did not?
I don't think you messed anything up. I mean, I think you covered
I always ask
everything.
that as the humility part, but it just means if there's anything else you want to talk about, really.
No, I mean, look, I think, I always say this to people, like, I think two of the things I get asked a lot are, how could you ever have worked for News Corp or the Conservatives, right? I'll hit that head on for a lot of people listening, because I think a lot more people listening are more progressive, and have, I don't, if you are impacted, I just want to remind people that, like, and I know people listening to this, a lot of them are impacted, that you don't really have a choice. Like, again, we're in the tough on crime era now, but we were on it then. And the first person to open his hand to me happened to be Rupert Murdoch's right-hand man. And as a 19, 20-year-old kid, I was like blown away that this individual wanted to give me a job. And that individual allowed me to transform my life. And like, I've always been like progressive. I always knew what I stood for, but I also knew that I had to take that opportunity to take that step up. And when I acquired my own privilege, I left. I went and did the Democrat stuff, the Obama stuff, and I even did it publicly. I controlled my own narrative. I wrote a story in his own paper about how the Conservatives were a sham to his, which, you'd think, oh, you burnt your bridges with your mentor. And no, he just kind of one day met up with me later and patted me on the back and said, well done, taught you well. And I think it's important to remind you, opportunity can come from anywhere. And a lot of people are really judgmental around where you take those chances, but no one who's really impacted or formerly incarcerated, a lot of people don't have a choice. And you've got to remind people that when they make those choices of where to work.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very powerful place to end. Thanks so much for doing this. And as always, a real great pleasure talking with you.
Great talking to you, Josh. Thank you.
Now, my take. As I write this, a commercial for the television show Law and Order just came on my television. The ad literally used the tagline, "Why Law and Order?" And then there was a strategic pause, and then, "Do the crime, do the time." I cannot tell you the amount of damage that that and all the other television shows do when they repackage and manufacture law enforcement narratives into entertainment for public consumption. To win, we will need a lot less of that and a lot more of what Trevor Noah did at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. If you missed it, he said, "I love the New York Times. I really do. You are all the best. You do some of the most accurate and precise reporting in news. You never fail to write down exactly whatever the police have given you to say." We need to aggressively defend our proposals and our people in the media, and we need to always explain why what we are doing is better for public safety. We need to turn the public safety debate against the scaremongers in the media in order to change the narrative, to truly change the narrative. We also need to create our own platforms and embrace alternative platforms in order to get more people to hear our messages. Most importantly, we need to find ways to infiltrate traditional media and always be on offense. We should always be suggesting why the world we are envisioning will be a safer world than the current world, where policing and incarceration become our only answers to violence and crime. I guess I am challenging everyone to try to find ways to be strategic, but also to try to flip the conventional narrative and to become tabloids for good in response to tabloids for evil. The conventional narrative holds that crime means more police and more arrests are the best way to ensure public safety. We have to always argue that alternatives to policing and alternatives to incarceration is actually what will make us not just better, but safer. Anyway, at the end of the day, we have to be involved not only in doing good work, but also changing the narrative and the way people hear the narrative in all forms of media across the United States. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give us a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from Patreon or have given a donation in the past. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or add us on Stitcher, Spotify, or from your favorite podcast app. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, to Ann Aspo for helping with our transcripts and social media images, and to Alex Mayo, who helps with our website. Make sure and add us on social media and share our posts across your networks. Also, thanks to my employer, Safe and Just Michigan, for helping to support the Decarceration Nation podcast. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.